Matter of fact, it started yesterday at noon when I got here, and he didn't show up at 5 o'clock, and I was getting nervous. And he made the mistake at breakfast this morning. He didn't feel well, and he may go home. And I said, God, don't do that. That'll only leave me on the podium. And Buckley will make me speak. But I thought I'd met Keith before, and I thought I'd been at a meeting where he spoke. But we got our dates and places together, and then I met him yesterday for the first time. And believe you me, you spend 5 hours on a golf course with a man, and you learn him pretty good. I like what I saw today. I saw a man that kept his cool, that enjoyed the day, enjoyed life, and enjoyed sharing his life with me. We didn't talk all that much AA, but we talked about everyday things, how we're enjoying life today, how much fun it is to get out with a bunch of people and just enjoy the day in the hot sun and chase that little old golf ball all over the cow pasture and try not to step in nothing. And he kept his cool. When I would miss a shot, I'd go storming off the green, and the words I said, I don't think they heard him because I didn't want them to. Sometimes I lose my cool on the golf course, but this man, I don't know what it is. When you meet somebody new in AA, instant friendship starts. And that's what Keith has meant to me this last day and a half that I've known him. I've really enjoyed it. And I'm not going to take up any more of his time. So if y'all will, please help me give him a good cordial welcome to Keith.
Thank you. My name's Keith Lewis. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Keith.
Mr. Mayor and your honor and honored guests, I'd like to say that I am truly delighted to be here. I was here, I was trying to figure it out, and I spoke at this wonderful roundup. It was like, I think, 17 years ago or something like that. And I was about 40 pounds lighter, and my mustache was black, but I'm a lot more spiritual now. I found that the older you get and the less desirable you are to women, the more spiritual you get. I can't figure that out. Must be some principle involved in that somewhere. I'm not sure what it is. Aristotle said, beware these freedoms, lest they destroy you. And the older you get, the fewer choices you have. So you have less freedom. And I'd like to also mention the golf tournament. I mean, I wasn't thinking much about it or anything, But I think it takes a lot of humility to put teams together and win. Perhaps next year you could put them in charge of your hospitality committee or something. It's great to be back in this lovely town. Boy, it's really grown. I was just amazed. I was telling David, my friend David drove up with me. You get to a certain age, they don't let you leave the state alone. And I bring you greetings from my lovely wife, Julia, who very much wanted to be here. We've had a lot going on in our family the last few weeks, and she wasn't feeling very well and needed to stay home. And I bring you greetings from my home group, the Cornerstone Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet on Wednesday nights at 8 o'clock in the beautiful town of Wilmington, North Carolina. And if you're ever in Wilmington, I hope you'll come and visit us. To be asked to do anything in a program of Alcoholics Anonymous is truly an honor, but to be asked to get up and share in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what I'm like now is truly an honor. I knew all the speakers except the gentleman who spoke this afternoon, Nick, and if you missed his talk, you really missed a fine talk. Michael last night was wonderful. Michael and I were in Richmond just 2 weeks ago, so I told her that what we might do is we could change stories. We know each other's stories well enough. And just sort of shake things up a little bit. I really think that we missed about 4 putts inside of 10 feet today. And I was trying to figure out during my prayer and meditation time why that was. And I think it was I was feeling so bad about the fact that Bo was here speaking while we were out playing golf. Bo's a dear friend, and we know each other well enough to be perfectly honest. Bo would never say anything like, "Don't talk too long," or anything like that. But what he said to me on the way in was, "Remember, ice cream melts." You know, you can probably tell from my accent or lack thereof that I'm not was not born in the state of North Carolina. I'm a naturalized citizen. Julia's from North Carolina, so I married in. But I was born in a small town on the Ohio River in the tri-state area, Wheeling, West Virginia, and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and Steubenville, Ohio, in that little area, in a little town called Martin's Ferry. And I'm the eldest son and the second child in a family of 11 children. I'm Irish. I won't tell you what church we went to. I'm going to make you guess. I will give you a hint. It has something to do with bingo. But I'm not going to say anymore, okay? I guess you would say that I grew up in poverty. I think that would be the term that would be used. And that's what I thought for many, many years. One of the magnificent gifts that I've been given in my time in Alcoholics Anonymous is the realization that I've been wrong about most everything. I was sober a short period of time, and I used to go and bug the old-timers. I don't know if you know any old-timers. So if you do, I'd recommend that you stay away from them. They're not very nice people. They lie a lot. They say things like, we go to meetings because we need to. That's a lie. They don't need to go to meetings. The reason they go to meetings is the only enjoyment they get out of life anymore is watching people like you and me suffer. And if you don't believe me, find one after the meeting, like Pat or somebody, and just tell them a problem. And the first thing they do is laugh. If you really want to make their day, tell them a problem about sex. They can get a big kick out of that, you know. I remember I was 29 years of age when I came to this wonderful program and got sober, and I was impotent, which will put a crimp in your sex life. And I kept it a secret for a while, and finally, just before it killed me, I went and made the mistake of telling an old-timer. And that was the best time he'd had in a long time. He immediately burst into laughter and said, and then he said, a lot of us had that problem. It'll get better. I said, well, when? I thought it was important. He said, well, you got a full social calendar? Ha, 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 you know. At any rate, their answer, the old-timers' answer about sex is always the same, no sex. You know, they're not having sex anymore, and they don't want us to have sex either. But at any rate, this old guy told me, he said, what I want you to do, he said, Keith, he said, I want you to borrow lipstick from, he'd never answer a question. It's another thing about old-timers. It's like they don't understand the question, or they forgot what it was before they have a chance to answer, but they always tell you to do something that's got nothing to do with the problem. I'm just telling you, my life is over, I'm thinking about the monastery or something. I mean, what the heck? And he tells me, he said, look, he said, Keith, he said, I want you to borrow some lipstick from one of the girls in the program. And he said, now, I don't want you doing anything else with the girls. And he said, oh, that's right, you can't. He said, but I want you to borrow lipstick from one of the girls in the program, and I want you to go home and write on your mirror, Keith, you were wrong. And I said to him, I said, well, I can't do that. You see, my problem is that I have a poor self-image. don't ever talk that way to an old-timer. They haven't read any of those books, I can tell you that. And so I didn't want to owe anything to anybody, especially a woman, so I went and bought my own tube of lipstick, and and I wrote on the mirror, "Keith, you were wrong," and I threw it in a trash can in utter disgust. And I was still living in the Skid Row section of Washington, D.C., in the humble abode that I was living in when I entered the program. And I lived there about 2.5 years till I got my financial life straightened out. But I wrote that on the mirror, and I threw the lipstick in the trash, and I was just enraged. I mean, I was enraged about everything, but I was just enraged. And I said, "These people are crazy. They're crazy." And I went to bed. And remember 60 days? I had a normal night. Remember a normal night, 60 days? I lay down and closed my eyes. And for the first time that day, my brain woke up. And it took off, you know? And it was talking to me. It was saying, "You're never going to make it. You're going to be alone the rest of your life. What difference does it make? You're impotent." And, you know, and just on and on and on and on. And finally, I'd drift off to sleep. And then the leg cramps. Remember the leg cramps? Oh. Boy, I'd come out of a sleep jumping up and down beside my bed wondering what had happened to me. And then about 15 minutes before I had to get up, I'd go sound asleep. And it would take 3 alarm clocks to wake me up. And then I'd get up, and depression was waiting on the bed, and it'd jump on me, and my mind was still working. It would say, "You're going to go to work today, and they're going to find out you don't know how to do your job, and they're going to fire you. And what difference does it make? You're hopelessly in debt." And, you know, just a normal morning. And I went out in the kitchen, and I'd start to make coffee, and some mornings I'd cry, you know, just so depressed and everything. And so I started the coffee, and I went in the bathroom, and I looked at the mirror, and it said, "Keith, you were wrong." I said, "Well, thank God, because if I'm right, I'm in a hell of a lot of trouble." I tell you. So one of the great principles of Alcoholics Anonymous is that I've been wrong about most everything. And I'm delighted to hear that, because just think if I'd have been right. Oh, gee. You know, just think if we'd have been right. Oh. We'd all be out stealing each other's cards or something right now, you know? So one of the great, great gifts I've been given is a realization that I've been wrong. And, you know, I've been absolutely certain about everything. I mean, I've been absolutely certain about everything, and I would be wrong about all of it. And I was certain that I grew up in poverty. And the reason I was certain of that is there were an awful lot of us, and we often didn't have a lot to eat, and we never had a family car or anything like that. We didn't have a television set. I mean, they were invented. Don't get me wrong, but we didn't have one. And I would have told you that we had great poverty, and I'd have been very, very wrong about that. My mother passed away a couple weeks ago, and she was buried. And here's a woman who never finished high school. And she raised 11 children. A brilliant woman. She read a book a day. She's extraordinary in so many ways. And every night at our dinner table, before we would eat, we would, of course, say our blessing. And then we would have to listen to and repeat either a word and a definition. We'd have to, and then we'd have to put this word in a sentence, and food's getting cold. Or she would give us a grammatical rule or something, and we'd have to repeat it back to her. Just an extraordinary woman. She had heart surgery a few years ago, and before she went into surgery, they had doped her up, you know, and she had that silly grin on her face. And before she went in, she sat up on a gurney and said, "Remember, boys, never, never, never end a sentence with a preposition." And the surgeon said to me, he said, "You know, I thought I had heard it all." You know, every day I was ever in the same place as that woman, she kissed me and hugged me and told me she loved me. I had a father who didn't say, "I loved you," in words, didn't for many, many years until after my 9th step, but said it in every action he ever took. He was a machinist. He worked in a steel mill, and he was a machinist. And and he made us batting tees. And he spent time with me every day I would let him. In the wintertime, we'd hone our baseball skills by hitting baseballs off the tee in the basement and taking ground balls off the back wall. And he taught me to play checkers. And we lived near the steel mills and the coal mines and the railroad tracks. And Dad would teach us all the things a kid needed to know to survive, about how you cross across the train that's parked and how they jerk when they start off, and you have to be careful you don't get thrown under the wheels, and all the things that a kid needed to know. I remember we go playing baseball. It'd be my dad and my brother, Dumb Denny, and we'd go up to the old mill field to play baseball. Every day he'd come back from the factory, and I know how tired he must have been, and he had a ritual, and he would heat a needle and pick the steel out of his fingers because they would get a lot of slivers of steel. And then he would do that, and then he'd wash his hands very well with Braxo, and then he'd put a peroxide on his hands so he wouldn't have infections. And then we would eat, and we'd go play ball. And then after we played ball, we'd say, "Dad, can we get a pop?" And pop was 6 cents a bottle. And sometimes we'd go to the little diner by the steel mill. It was a railroad car diner. And he'd say, "Yeah." And he'd get a root beer, and I'd get an orange, and Dumb Denny would get a grape. And since the men were in the factory and there was no one there, they would let us sit at the counter, and we would drink our pop. And, you know, some days he'd say to me, he'd drop back, and he'd check in his pocket, and he'd say, "I'm not very thirsty. Maybe you and Denny get a pop, and I'll take a drink of yours." And then some days he'd say, "Mom looked pretty lonely when we left. She would probably like it if we'd come home and have some Kool-Aid or something. I'll bet she's got some iced tea or some Kool-Aid." And those were the days when he didn't have 12 cents in his pocket. And yet, I would have told you that I was raised in poverty. And of course, I was dead wrong. I was raised in tremendous wealth, tremendous, tremendous wealth. You know, when I was sober 4 years, I made direct amends to my mother, and I said to her, "Is there anything that I could do beyond what I've done to make amends for my behavior, the way you've worried about me?" I was discharged from the Marine Corps. They didn't see me for 14 days. They called every state between North Carolina and in Ohio, checking in hospitals and with the state troopers, have you found a body? Has there been an accident? And I was in an after-hours joint with a pimp and four hookers in Charleston, West Virginia, and came out of a blackout. I was driving a big yellow Cadillac because we were driving this pimp to Moundsville State Penitentiary because he had a report to do 2 years. And I was driving, and the problem with that was I didn't know how to drive. And I was in front of the Moundsville State Penitentiary, and we're all crying and waving to this guy. I didn't know his name or anything. And I came back out of the blackout, and I'm driving to Charleston, and the four girls and I are saying what a bum he really was and all the rest of it. And then I didn't know anything for two more days. I mean, I was that kind of a drinker, And I said to this woman, "Is there anything I can do to make amends for the heartache and the worry I've caused you?" And she said, and she had seen I had a chip. You know, we have tokens to denote lengths of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she said, "I saw that little thing you have in your pocket with a four on it." She said, "I'd sure like to have one of those." So I gave it to her. And every year from then on, I'd send her a chip, and if I forgot, she'd let me know. She'd say, "It must have gotten lost in the mail, son." And I'd say, "Oh, I forgot to send it." And I'd send it to her. And just before she died a few weeks ago, she asked the things that she wanted in her coffin, and she wanted my 23-year chip. And she wants me to send one to somebody from here on out. And by the grace of God, every year that I'm sober, I will. And I would have told you that I grew up in poverty. You know, I think it's important to when we inventory in that 10th step that we look at the tremendous blessings that we've been given. I mean, I believe everybody here, everybody who gets sober because somewhere along the line we were given a set of values. a point beyond which our spirits would not permit us to go. I like to talk about my first drink. I think if you're going to be an alcoholic, you have to have a first drink. It's hard to be an alcoholic without one. And my first one happened when I was 5 years old. It happened at home. I didn't go out much when I was five. And I was at home, and my father was watching myself and Dumb Denny. I was five, and Denny was four. My mother was out. She was either at the bingo or having a baby or something. And we're sitting around the kitchen table playing Bug and other sophisticated games. I think my father thought it might be cute. And there was rarely alcohol around the house because both of my parents had parents who could be diagnosed as alcoholic without trying hard. And so they rarely had alcohol around the house, but there were a few beers in the refrigerator, and I guess my dad thought it just might be funny. And so he gave each of us a beer. We set it to table, and he gave us those little jelly glasses. Remember the ones with superheroes on them and things? And mine had Superman on it. I don't know if that's significant. Psychologists might think so. And we drank our beer, and nothing happened to me. I mean, nothing. But Denny, I looked over, and old Dumb Denny was sliding out of the chair, and he was rolling around under the table singing Mary Had a Little Lamb and other drinking songs, you know. And my father panicked and wrestled poor Denny to the ground, and he got his clothes off him. He put his jammies on, and he carried him upstairs and put him in bed, and he said to me, "Get ready for bed, son." I said, "All right." And so I went up and got in bed, and Denny and I shared a room, And Denny was laughing and carrying on, and I'll never forget it as long as I lived. Denny stood up in his little crib, and he urinated on the floor. And I remember thinking, you know, there's a kid who's powerless over alcohol and whose life has become unmanageable. And you know, it's the saddest thing, you know. Old Denny just never made it, you know what I mean? I mean, he just never developed beyond that point. We're not proud of this, but I'll tell you some of the things Denny's done. It'll break your heart. Denny grew up and he went to college and he had one major. And he graduated in 4 years. He went to one graduate school, and, you know, straight A's, and he graduated on time. And he looked around, and he had like eight job offers. He took one, you know. he's a executive vice president in a large international corporation. He represented him here at the Olympics. And the saddest thing of all was he married one woman. Now, here's a guy who had the world in the palm of his hands when he was 4 years old, and he just let it slip through his fingers, you know? I had to work at this thing. I was 23 years old before I urinated on the bedroom floor for the first time, you know? You know, when we talk about seeing and sharing love, you know, I can certainly give millions of examples, ample examples of my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. And like the book says, I can also give ample examples of love in my life prior to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I look back at my childhood. I was a kid who had a very bad speech impediment, a very, very bad speech impediment. And I was so loved, I didn't know I had it. I mean, I knew on some level that I didn't sound like other people, but I didn't think it mattered. I was that loved. And I remember we'd be in school, and I was in the first grade, and a nun said, "Does anybody here know a song?" And my mother I put my hand up, and I jumped up, and my mother went, "Oh," you know. I sang, and nobody could understand a word that I sang. And my mother told me it was the most beautiful thing she ever heard. And those were the jewels that were always there. And it was a nun and another teacher who spent many hours trying to train me to talk. And I'd have to do all these exercises, like wrap my tongue around a pencil and everything. And I learned to concentrate to form words, and I still do. And just incredible displays of love, heroic love. And it was heroic because it didn't seem out of place. It didn't seem extraordinary. I was never under the impression that anybody was ever doing anything out of the ordinary for me. I remember watching my mother function, and I know I'm talking a lot about her, but I've been thinking a lot about her. She's only been gone a couple weeks, and I was thinking about how she would make sandwiches in the morning when we'd all go to school. She looked like a Vegas dealer. I mean, she'd deal out the bread and then deal out the bologna or whatever we had to put between the bread, and every kid in our family wanted something different. If you're from a big family, you want something different, and we all wanted something different, and you know, one would want butter, the other one wouldn't want butter. They want butter on one piece of bread, but not on the other piece of bread, and on and on. And the only one that was really confused was my brother Henry, good old Henry. Henry said he wanted one sandwich, so my mother made him one sandwich and cut it in half, and he brought half of it back. And he said, "Mom, I only wanted one sandwich." So my mother said, "Keith, would you, you know, you're the oldest brother, you have pretty heavy responsibilities." She said, "Would you explain this to Henry?" I said, "I'd be delighted." And I took Henry aside, and I was thinking, this is too good to pass up. So I told Mom, I said, "I think I've got it figured out. I'll make Henry sandwich tomorrow." And she said, "Well, thank you." And so you guessed it. I took a half a sandwich, and I cut it in half. And he brought back a quarter of a sandwich. You know. This guy's now a head of security for Wheeling Pittsburgh Steel. If that doesn't scare you, it ought to. You know, I also remember a woman named Sister Victoria who taught me a lot. She, in her, I saw love, and I saw her share it. She was a librarian in a little high school I went to, and I was, if we'd have had money, I would have been diagnosed as an acting out adolescent. We were really poor, so I was just a punk. And I got into a fair amount of trouble in high school, and we had served detention with Sister Victoria, and what we had to do was make rosary beads. I don't know if some of you probably know what those are. They're things Catholics pray on, and the way they're put together is you put 10 beads in a decade, and there are 5 decades in this rosary. And so I got pliers and wire, and I'm making rosary beads. And Sister Victoria used to say, "Every boy's a prince, and every girl's a princess, because we have a father who's a king." And we laugh at her and call each other Prince Keith and Princess Mary and things. And so I'd served detention with Sister Victoria in a library and spent a lot of time with Sister Victoria. And she used to put me behind a magazine rack. She said I was a prince, but I was also contagious. So I'd sit back there making rosary beads, and mine were different. I made them with 11 beads in all the decades. And I did this for years. And by the time it came time for me to graduate from high school, I had hundreds of mutant rosary beads. And they were all over the world because they'd send them to the missions. And you know, you can't let something like this go unnoticed. And she never said anything. And so finally, just before I graduated, I said, "Sister, do you know what I've been doing?" And she said, "Yes, you sly little prince." She said, "You've been putting extra beads in all the rosaries." And she said, "I know why." And I thought, I hope she tells me, because I have the foggiest notion of why I do these things. And she said, "You're doing it so people will pray extra prayers, and God's going to give you all the credit." Don't you hate people like that? You know? And then she said something that just scared me to death. She took both of my hands and she looked into my eyes and she said, "You know, God loves you very, very much, and you're a very special little prince. And one day, God's going to send you all over the world to tell his children how very much he loves them." I remember how terrified I was at a thought like that, a responsibility like that. You know, because I was a kid who didn't understand anything. I was a kid with a speech impediment. I was a kid who had no earthly idea what he wanted to do when he grew up. And it seemed to me everybody else did. I was a kid who thought the rest of the world had the big picture, and I was the only one who was left out. And I hung around for about a week after I graduated, and it occurred to me that I didn't know what I wanted to do, and I thought everybody else did. Now, my thought was, if you don't know what you want to do with your life, you better go away. Because wherever you go, they won't know you don't know what you want to do. They'll think you're doing it. So where I was, and back then, everybody went in the military. All the men went in the military. It wasn't if, it was where and when. That was it. And so I went home, and I took one of my very first inventories. I stood in front of the mirror. I took my shirt off, and I flexed my muscles, and I turned sideways and stuck my chest out. And I was 5'1" tall, and I weighed 113 pounds. And whatever else I was a born killer. So so I went over and joined the Marine Corps. And my poor mother cried all night. And I was 17 years old, so they had to sign for me, and they did. But she cried all night, and she kept saying, "Scott, they'll kill him." And my dad kept saying, "Don't worry, Pat, they won't take him." And with that vote of confidence, the next morning we got in a taxi cab and went to Wheeling, West Virginia, and they put me on a Trailways bus to Pittsburgh, which was 60 miles away, which is the second longest trip I'd ever taken in my life. And I took off for Pittsburgh, and I found the old post office building, and it was a very bad year, and if you had a pulse, they took you. So that afternoon, I was sworn into the Marine Corps. And that afternoon, that thing happened to me that happens to everybody who's alcoholic, or I think every alcoholic I've ever met. And that happened in a little bar in Pittsburgh. There were three guys from the Pittsburgh area who joined, and we were all going to Parris Island together. And our train left at midnight, and it was about 4 o'clock. And this one man said, "Look, we're going to go over and have a beer and a sandwich. You want to join us?" And I thought, what do I know? I'm from out of town. So I followed him over there. And we went into this bar. And I don't know if you've ever been in a bar in Pittsburgh, but it's filled with real men. And all the men have a real woman with them. You know how that works. So I go following these guys in this bar, you know, and the bartender came over. He is a real man, you could tell, and he said, "What do you want?" And I thought, oh, my God, a quiz. I always thought that when you least expected it, somebody was going to say, "Take out a blank sheet of paper and put your name in the upper left-hand corner," and I hadn't studied the right stuff. I studied a lot, but I never studied the right stuff. And I didn't know how to answer that question, so I watched the other guys, and they ordered a beer, so I did too. And then they ordered another one, and then he came back the third time, and I knew the answer, and I ordered first. And that's when it happened for me. Somewhere between the second and third beer, I stood up. I didn't mean to stand up, I just stood up. And I don't believe I could have kept from standing up. And I looked down, and the floor was 6'4" below me, and my right shoulder was out to here, my left shoulder was out, and the muscles were rippling through my body, you know, and that mind that had been filled with fear and everything, and like the Marine Corps, I didn't know anything about the Marine Corps, I didn't think you could ask. All I knew about the Marine Corps is they took a certain percentage of young men to South Carolina and drowned them in a swamp. That's the only thing I knew about the Marine Corps, And all of a sudden, I knew everything there was to know about everything. It was amazing. And I remember saying, "But of course, it's so simple. It's so simple. Why didn't I see it before?" And then I looked around, and my heart broke because this bar was filled with a bunch of pathetic, sniveling little men. And all of them had women with them or looking at me with their hungry eyes. You know how they do it. And I spent the rest of the night just going from table to table, filling these people in. And I mean, they had so many questions. And I answered all their questions. And then I answered some questions they didn't have questions for yet, for later. It was just incredible. It was a most wonderful moment of my life. And that's why I'm convinced that that's the day I became an alcoholic. Now, I got a lot sicker than that. But I don't believe I ever got any more alcoholic than that, because I spent the rest of my drinking career, 12 years, trying to get back to Pittsburgh. You know? And I mean, I'd start to drink in Athens or Naples or who knows where. And my one thought was, I'd love to get to Pittsburgh. And I never felt that good again, ever. Oh, I got close from time to time. You know? That magic between a second and third drink. Early in my drinking, I could keep it for a long time. Drinking Ouzou and Creed. It didn't matter. But you know, towards the end of my drinking, I'd take that second drink and that third drink, and, you know, and I'd be shaking, and I'd be waiting for that feeling to come by and to come on me, and it would go, boom, be gone. Yeah. But, you know, it was worth it. It was worth it. It was worth it because it might happen. And that's my alcoholism. And I can sum up my alcoholism in just about a minute. My alcoholism is a disease that ensured I'd violate virtually every principle associated with my way of life. Then I would blame that way of life. You know, the next morning I woke up on that train. I was laying on the floor of the Pullman coach the Marine Corps had provided me, and someone had wet the floor I was lying on, and they had wet me too, and I got up and washed off and changed clothes, and I got off the train, and I joined the guys on the platform, and they said, we're going to go over and have a few beers for breakfast. You want to join us? And I thought, what do I know? I'm from out of town, and I was 17 years old, and I was skinny and weighed 113 pounds again, so I followed them over there, and that evening, I fell off the train in Yamasee, South Carolina. It was like somebody moved the bottom step or something, and I fell across the next set of tracks. And there was a very rude man there they had sent to greet us. And he was hurling obscenities at myself and the other young men who had gone there to die for their country. And I remember getting up trying to explain to this cretin that he would probably do a lot better if he treated us with a little dignity. And, you know, he never seemed to catch on to what it was I was trying to tell him. They say you learn from every experience. And what I learned that night was you can do a lot of push-ups drunk. A lot of push-ups drunk. And I'll tell you something else. I hope you never need to know this, but you can do push-ups and throw up at the same time. You know? And they also say there's something you'd be grateful for in every episode. What I'm grateful for was the fact that he didn't have me doing sit-ups. So I was launched into the Marine Corps, and I just loved the Marine Corps. I loved everything about it. The barracks was less crowded than my home, and the drill instructors were nicer to me than the nuns. And so I took to it like a duck to water. I loved everything about it. I gained about 30 pounds and grew a few inches. And I won Dress Blues Award and Outstanding Man's Award off of Paris Island. And every promotion I ever got was a meritorious promotion. And I was the youngest NCO in the Marine Corps one time. And my goal was to become the youngest officer, the youngest commissioned officer. And I won an appointment to Quantico. Something had happened to me called alcoholism. And what alcoholism means is that I'll violate every principle associated with my way of life. Then I'll blame that way of life. And I ended up in combat, I ended up leading a patrol in a combat zone in a blackout. I don't remember going out, and I don't remember coming back. By the grace of God, nobody was hurt. And I knew that I violated every principle when I left. And I would have told you that the Marine Corps was an abnormal way to live, and that's why I drank the way I did. And then I went on and took on a couple other things in life, and suffice it to say that the answer was always the same. I married, and I married a woman who deserved better, and she ended up living with a man who violated every principle associated with marriage. And it was difficult for me because I watched examples of marriage and fatherhood that were beyond belief, and yet I ended up breaking this woman's heart. The night her father died, she found out at 5 o'clock in the evening, and I got home at 2 o'clock that morning, dead drunk, and she was 8.5 months pregnant. She was sitting on the floor sobbing, and the floor around her was soaking wet. She'd been crying for hours, and her husband was out drunk. Our second daughter was born, Kimberly, and she was almost 3 months premature, and I was passed out on the living room floor. And she threw water on me and everything she could to try to wake me up. And finally she called the people next door. She was nearly panicked and called the people next door. Maybe they'd help her get to the hospital. And they came in, and I finally woke up and I was enraged. I didn't know who to blame. To blame her for letting the baby come early or blame the baby for coming early. Because I was convinced that if she had that baby when she was supposed to, I'd have been all right. You know, if she'd have waited till I was all right, she'd have carried that baby for 2.5 years. You know, and I put her in a car, and I rushed her to the hospital where I worked. I was a director of genetics units, genetics laboratories, Georgetown University. And I took her to that hospital, and I was drunk and smelled of booze, reeked of booze. And I was demanding that they take care of my wife, which is really a joke, you know, because I did anything but take care of her. And I got home, and I got into bed, and the phone rang, and she was crying and said, our baby has hyaline membrane disease, and they don't think she'll live. And she weighed about 1.5 pounds, and she said, would you please come in? And I came in, and I was just completely helpless. I didn't know how sick I was until the night our offices were across from the neonatal nursery, and this little thing was in there in something called a negative respirator, which was in a new invention. It was the first one on the East Coast. It was put together 3 days before Kimberly was born. And I sat in my office with the door slightly ajar in the dark so no one would know I was there. And I watched this baby fight for her life. And I was terrified. By this time, I had come to realize that God must be very angry with me because of the way I was living. And I thought if God found out how very much I loved this little thing, that he'd take her, because it seemed to me that everything I ever wanted I was losing. And I thought that my wanting it was the reason I was losing it. And I remember the day that my wife went in and baptized Kimberly, because at 72 hours it's a very critical time, and they didn't think she would live, and they thought that if she did live she'd be severely retarded. And my wife went in and baptized Kimberly, and everything inside of me wanted to do what my father would have done, which is run in there and be with them. I'd like to have put my arms around both of them and say, don't worry, we'll make this thing work, and I'll be here for you. But there was nothing left of me. And I went down that night in a chapel, and I'd been a pretty religious kid, and the book says that we often return to the church of our childhood, and I have. I love the church that I grew up in now, and I'm a very active participant. But I hadn't been in that church for quite a while, and we had a chapel in this hospital, and I went down, and I went in, and I knelt before the tabernacle. And in my religion, a tabernacle is a very special place because we believe that the Son of God lives there. Takes residence in a tabernacle, actual presence. And I got on my knees and I begged God to let her live. And I said, if you'll let that kid live, I won't drink. And I was drunk in less than 24 hours. I was drunk thinking that drinking would kill my baby. And I drank anyway. So when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous a couple years later and they said to me, do you believe you're powerless over alcohol? I said, absolutely, I know I am. There's a great philosopher and mathematician who said that Blaise Pascal, he said, you know, God created man in his own image, and unfortunately man returned the favor. And I had created a God in my image, which was spiteful and angry and punishing, and thank God I was wrong about God. Because God wouldn't kill a little kid because her dad's sick. And she didn't die, and it's absolutely miraculous. And about 4 years ago, she graduated with honors from Auburn University. And she's now married and to a wonderful young man, and they're going to live in Dolphin, Alabama. he's going to practice, and he's a dentist, and she's a school teacher. And it's a special child. I think she came so close to death that she talked to the angels or did something, because she has the attitude of someone who would be an Alcoholics Anonymous 30 years. She was 6 years old. She acted like an old-timer. Scary. You know, I ended up going where alcoholics need to go to get better. I ended up in the Skid Row section of Washington, D.C. My wife couldn't have me around the kids. I couldn't be trusted. I was falling asleep with cigarettes and all that business. And I needed to go there to get here. And I hit bottom in a very, very profound way on May the 13th, 1973. And from that day to this day, I've not had to take a drink. I went to my first meeting on May the 16th. I walked up to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no earthly idea what Alcoholics Anonymous was all about. I didn't know it existed. And I walked up to a door. I was in a little treatment center, and they put us on a bus and took us to this meeting. And I walked up, and there was a man they called a greeter who stood and shook your hand. And he shook my hand and looked me in the eye, which I thought was sort of obnoxious. I was kind of a shoe person. I like to look at shoes, but I noticed around here people look you in the eye a lot. And this guy's looking me in the eye, and he said, "Oh, you're new." And I thought, my God, he's psychic. And then he shook my hand firmly, and he made me a promise. He said, "You keep coming here, son, you never have to drink again." And I thought to myself, he doesn't know. I'm a guy who would drink thinking it would kill his baby. He doesn't know. Of course I have to drink again. Of course I have to. And he was right. And I was wrong about not having to drink. And then he took me in there, and he set me down next to a woman. She's the oldest human being I ever saw. She's 10 days older than dirt. And she got me a half a cup of coffee, and she sat beside me and patted me. And halfway through the meeting, she looked at me, and that old face exploded into a smile. And she said, "Son, if you stay with us, you never have to be alone again." And I began to cry, because she didn't know that I had to be alone. I had to be alone. She didn't know the kind of person I was. I mean, I was the kind of guy who left a four-month-old daughter in the crib because he needed to get to the liquor store to get a drink, and then hated himself forever. I was the kind of guy who came out of a blackout and hit his wife so hard he blacked her eye. She didn't know what kind of a person I was. And I was wrong, and she was right. And I was launched into what's turned out to be an incredible experience. It's beyond my wildest dreams what's happened to me. And I don't mean the big things. I mean the little things. The way I see and saw love shared. I mean, it's just incredible to me, watching people. My sponsor made me report to the intergroup office on Monday night from 7 to 10. He said, "I want you to report down there. I answer the phones, and I want you to keep me company." And I said, "Well, I can't go. You see, that's Monday night football." Big mistake. He said, "What we're seeking in your life is balance, Keith." He said, "All these years," he said, "you pass out and you miss the second half of the football." He said, "We're going to make sure you get to the second half, and you're going to miss the first half." So we sought balance, and I was down there obsessing back and forth. I was the most self-centered, narcissistic human being I ever saw. I might say something like, "Enough about me. What do you think of my jacket?" I couldn't get away from me, and I was pacing back and forth, and one time, and he's on the phone talking to this woman who's drunk. And this woman called the intergroup, and she was drunk, and she invited him to come over and spend the night. And I heard him say, "No, ma'am, we don't do it that way. It's anonymous." He said, "What I'll do is I'll have a couple ladies come over and talk with you." And she called him and cursed him out and everything. And he said, "Please call us back if you feel you need to." And I looked at this man, and I was overwhelmed with the realization that here's a man who's doing something for someone he doesn't know, and no one will ever know he did it. And I had thought that there's only so much credit in the world, and if you get some of it, I get less. And if I did something in secret, it didn't stay that way for long. I was sure to tell you about it. And here's a man who's living very, very differently than that. And I was wrong about credit. What made him magnificent was what he did that people didn't know about. Not what he did that they didn't know about. And I was wrong about credit. I was wrong about everything. Remember, I couldn't sleep. I don't know if you have any new people here who can't sleep. And I used to go to meetings. At the very end of the meetings, they'd say something like, does anybody here have a problem that might cause them to drink before 8:30 tomorrow night? And I'd put up my hand. I'd say, what is it now, Keith? I'd say, I can't sleep. And they'd take turns. You know, I mean, I just loved it. They'd just take turns saying, nobody ever died from not sleeping. And you don't want to talk that way to somebody who hadn't slept in a while, you know. So I leapt to my feet one night and screamed, no, but people died from saying nobody ever died from not sleeping. And so I go on my midnight jaunts. I couldn't sleep, and I'd be going crazy, and I'd hurt so bad inside. Sometimes I'd sit and hold my knees up against myself and rock back and forth. And you told me to call you, but I didn't think you meant it. I thought you were just saying that to be nice, but I didn't think you meant it. And so I get my car and I drive around all night. I just drive all around Washington. I go to all the monuments. I'd read all that stuff. I'd read the same thing night after night. Yeah, I mean, I couldn't remember anything. It was like it was brand new. I mean, I cried over the same stuff in the Lincoln Memorial night after night. That's beautiful. I wonder why I never saw that before. Finally, one night I went over to the Jefferson Memorial, and I went out, and it was in August, and I got sober in May, and I laid down in the grass, and I looked at the stars, and I fell sound asleep. And I woke up. I said, this is wonderful. I said, the problem is I can't sleep. The problem is I've been trying to sleep in the wrong place. And so I went home, and I got my sleeping bag, and I brought it back, and I laid it out in the Jefferson Memorial, and I laid down, and I looked at the stars, fell sound asleep. And about an hour later, somebody's kicking me. And I woke up, and it was the park police. And he said, what are you doing? I said, I'll tell you what I'm doing. And I told him my story. He said, no kidding. This is the only place you can sleep? I said, I swear to you. I said, I've been sober since May the 13th, and this is the only place I found I can sleep. He said, well, I'll tell you what, buddy. He said, you need to sleep. You come here. Yeah. And every few nights, you know, you go crazy. I don't know if anybody here, you don't sleep, you get nuts, you know. I mean, I was not in line for the mental health award when I slept. When I didn't sleep, I was in bad shape. And so I'd get nuts, and I'd go down there, I'd lay the thing out, and I'd be laying there, you know, and I'd hear, Keith, is that you? I'd say, yeah. They'd say, how many days? I'd say, 76 days. Well, that's wonderful. You want some coffee? I said, no, I better get some rest. I have to go to work. And they said, well, don't worry. He said, we'll keep an eye on you. We won't let anything happen to you. And I was wrong about the police. I was wrong about the police. You know, the eighth step tells us that most people treat us the way we force them to treat us. And I think that's absolutely true. You know, I was wrong about sponsors. I thought a sponsor's job was to find out what you really most wanted in life and tell you you couldn't have it. Seemed that way to me. He laughed at all my good ideas. And I was sober about 3 months, and I got a letter from what's probably the greatest cytologist alive at that time, a man named Jerome Lejeune. And he was a professor at the University of Paris Medical School. And he invited me to come and study with him, study a technique called chromosome banding. And I knew my sponsor wouldn't let me go, and I was not going to give him the satisfaction of telling me no. So I was just going to tear up the letter. And then I thought, well, I'll give him a chance. And we went to lunch. I paid. And after we ate lunch, he had dessert. I insisted. And I gave him the letter, and he read the letter, and tears came to his eyes. And he said, isn't this wonderful? And I said, you mean I can go? He said, you have to go. You must go. He said, this isn't about you. He said, you're a rummy who left to his own devices. The best he could do was to urinate on himself in Skid Row. He said, this is about Alcoholics Anonymous. and a loving God of the second tradition that makes miracles happen. You don't owe it to you. You owe it to Alcoholics Anonymous to do this. And I never forget it as long as I live. And he said something to me, if you're new, I hope you'll hear this, and I hope you'll believe it, because I swear to you it's true. If you think your life is over, you're wrong. You are dead wrong. He said to me, Keith, you can do anything in the world if you prepare properly. I said, what do you mean? He said, the steps. We prepare for life by taking the steps. We prepare properly. We can do anything in the world. And we spent the next few months preparing properly. And you know, January the 1st, 1974, I was on a plane settling through the clouds into Orly Airport in France. And I'm glad I was sitting alone next to the window, because I couldn't keep from sobbing. Just 6 months before, I couldn't leave an apartment in a Skid Row section of Washington, D.C. And now I'm walking the streets of Paris. Only in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I spent a fair amount of time over there. And as luck would have it, my sponsor came through town. I don't know how those things happen. We spent a wonderful week together in Paris and just had some wonderful experiences. And I never thought I could ever be of any service to anybody, because I thought you couldn't make a mistake. If you made a mistake, people didn't want you around. I don't know where I learned this. It was probably my idea, but I had that feeling. And so I was very reluctant to do 12-step work. And my sponsor called me up. I was sober about 2 months. And he said, we're going to go on a 12-step call to the D.C. jail. I said, well, I'm kind of busy. He said, are you writing your 4th step? I said, no. He said, then get in the car. And so we went over to the D.C. He'd have me pick him up. And we went to the D.C. jail, and we went in to talk to a man. And I watched this man talk to this man. He's through the glass, so he's talking on the phone. And he talked to him, I bet you, 45 minutes. This kind, gentle man who was my sponsor. Never raised his voice, never did anything. And I see this guy on the other side of the glass. I couldn't hear him, but he's pretty wild-eyed, bushy-tailed, and in his wrinkled blue uniform. And so he said to me, he said, I brought a friend with me who's doing really well. He said, he's sober for 90 days. He said, he's doing really well. I want to let him talk to you for 5 minutes. I thought, 5 minutes? I got a lot to say to this guy. And so I began to preach, and I didn't take a breath for 3 minutes. I just tell him all this stuff, and finally the guy said, wait a minute. He said, look, pal. He said, that's fine for an idiot like you. He said, but I'm a Fulbright scholar. And I just lost it. And I began to scream, well, Mr. Fulbright scholar, one of us is leaving here in a few minutes, and one of us is going back to his cell. Guess which one that is? And I was screaming in the phone. And the guards started coming, and the other guests were looking around into our cubicle. And Dan reached for the phone, and I wasn't finished. So I was down on my knees cradling this phone where nobody could get to it, and I'm screaming at this guy, this Fulbright scholar, and I'm screaming at him, and finally the sponsor got the phone away from me, and he said, I'll be back, see you tomorrow, and he hung up the phone, and he said, you ready? And so we left, and I just knew that I made a big mistake, and if you make a mistake, somehow you have to go. And we were walking across the parking lot, and I said to Dan, I said, well, that wasn't very good, was it? You know what he said to me? He said, well, Keith, he said, you know, most guys wouldn't have done it that way. He said, but you're going to discover in Alcoholics Anonymous, we all develop our own technique. And I never heard another word about it. You know? You know, when we talk about sharing love and that sort of thing, so many names come to my mind, and so many of the old-timers are gone now who did so much for me. A guy like Buck Doyle, who taught me to laugh at myself. And Buck was telling me, he came, and I used to have lunch with him often, and I just cherish every moment I ever spent with him. I can remember, and this is no exaggeration, I mean, I can't remember yesterday, but I can remember every word that man ever said to me. And that's the truth. I can recount every time we were ever together. And we were together many, many times. And I can recall them all. And I remember he met me for lunch one day, and this man was sober a long time, and he came in laughing, and he said, "You know, Keith, sometimes I think I'll never get any better." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "I went running this morning." And he said, "I ran 6 miles." He said, "I'm 63 years old, and I ran 6 miles." He said, "That's good." I said, "Buck, that's great." He said, "You know, I'm coming back from the run." And he said, "There's a guy who lives in the same apartment building as me. He says he's crippled. He says he's got braces on, and he walks with crutches." And he said to me, "Buck, you've been running?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "How far did you run?" And Buck said, "I told him 7 miles. He said, "Here's a guy who can't even walk. You know, he said he'd have been real impressed with 6 miles, but it wasn't good enough. I had to tell him 7. He said, "I'll never get any better." And I thought, "I'm glad you feel that way. Because I'll never be enough. I'll never be enough. I have to add to it. You know, my greatest form of lying is that I add to it. It's my greatest form of lying." And nobody cares. Nobody gives a damn. But I feel compelled to do it. And I remember one time, this thing of guilt. I don't know if anybody here ever had a problem with guilt. No? I went to an old-timer. You got to be careful with them. And said to this old-timer, I said, "What do I do about guilt?" He laughed. He said, "Well, first thing you do is you stop doing that shit you feel guilty about." I said, "Is there another way?" He said, "Yeah, Valium, but it don't seem to work too good." It's tremendous guilt about my kids. I mean, you know, really just tremendous guilt. And I think about it, I was probably sober about 9 months. 9 months is a big guilt time, you know. And I was sober about 9 months, and I was feeling so bad that I was sitting in a place after a meeting, and I could see people's mouths going, and I couldn't hear anything they said. I don't know if you've ever been in that state. I was terrified, and I was getting up to leave, and I didn't know what was going to happen to me, but I knew it couldn't be good. And I was leaving, and a man named Harold pulled me aside, and he's a black man, and he said, "I don't know you," he said, "but I've been watching you, and you seem to be a good member." He said, "Would you have a cup of coffee?" And I figured, what do I know? I'm probably going to go to die. I got time. And so I sat down and had a cup of coffee, and he said to me, "What's bothering you?" And I said, "I feel guilty, Harold. I feel just so guilty." I said, "I've been a lousy father." I said, "My kids are almost like 4 and 5 now, and I've just been a terrible father," and going on and on. I said, I can't see them, or if I do see them, I, you know. And he said to me, he said, "I know how you feel." He said, "My mama died, and day before she died, she called all the kids and said, 'Would you come to the hospital tomorrow? I want to see you, because I think I'll be passing on.' She said, 'But Harold, I don't want you drinking. If you're drinking, don't come.'" And he said, "The next morning I was at the hospital," and he said, "I was drunk, Keith." I said, "You were?" He said, "Of course I was." He said, "I was an alcoholic." He said, "Alcoholics get drunk when things are good, and they get drunk when things are bad." And he said, "My brothers and sisters said to me, 'You can't go up there because you're drunk, Harold.'" And he said, "So I called, and Mama got on the phone, and I said, 'Mama, can I come and see you?' She said, 'You drinking, Harold?' And he said, 'Yeah.' She said, 'I don't want to see you. I don't want to go into eternity seeing my boy drunk.'" And he said, "I sat down in the waiting room while my brothers and sisters were with my mom, and she died." And I said, "How do you live with that?" And he said something to me. He said, "You know, Keith, the worst you ever do will become your greatest gift." And I'm thinking, I don't understand this, but I forgot about myself. And went home and got a decent night's sleep. And it must have been about, 3 months later, I was at the hospital working, and I was walking by the elevator, and here comes Harold. And we shook hands and talked for a few minutes, and he got on the elevator, and this nurse came up to me and said, "Do you know Mr. B? And I said, "Oh, yeah, Harold, I know Harold." She said, "He's the finest man I know." I said, "Really?" And I'm thinking that he's going there to do 12-step calls. She said, "Yeah." She said, "Whenever we have an old person here who doesn't have anybody and they're dying, we call Harold. And he comes and helps them." And those words rang in my head. "The worst you've ever done will become your greatest gift." That's the uniqueness of Alcoholics Anonymous. The things that I'm most ashamed of, the things I've been most guilty about, become my greatest badges. I was so moved when Elizabeth Dole was describing her husband's bad arm, and he said to her mother, I want to show you this. And she said, oh, your badge of courage. And you know, with all the things that are hurt and destroyed in my life, become the things that are most valuable to other human beings. Alcoholism, I think, is a training ground for the greatest ability to share love there is. And so all those things, the key, of course, are the steps. Because if I come to believe that I'm powerless, utterly powerless over alcohol, my life's unmanageable. If I truly come to believe that the only way out for me is to seek something outside of myself, and that means being wrong about a lot of things, and I can humble myself to the point that I can get on my knees and ask God to run my life, and then I can sit down and I can take a good, honest, thorough inventory what I've done and how it's affected others. And then I can share that with God, myself, and another human being. And I think that's critical. You know, when I did my fourth step and my sponsor told me, he sent me to a man, he said, I don't want you to take your fifth step with me, Keith, because my opinion of you is too important and I'm afraid you won't be brutally honest with me. It was great wisdom. And so I went to another man, and this man said, now I want you to read the book, and I want you to do the fifth step just like it says. And I read it, and suddenly it occurred to me what he meant. And so I took my fifth step, and I put on a three-piece suit, and I went to a little chapel. And I, because the fifth step says admit it to God, to ourselves, and to another human being, the exact nature of our wrong. And I took my fourth step to this little chapel, and I sat in front of a tabernacle, very much like the one I begged God to save my daughter's life. And I said, remember me. I'm Keith, and I'm an alcoholic. Remember, I used to serve Mass when nobody else wanted to. I mean, you have to lay the groundwork. And I believe for the first time in my life, I was brutally honest with God. I told him exactly what I thought I was. And then I went home and I sat in front of a mirror and I kept on my three-piece suit and I told myself exactly who I thought I was. I was brutally honest with myself. You know, I always thought I was afraid of what people would think. I was afraid of me and God. And once I did that, I could have taken my fifth step with a bus driver. Wouldn't have mattered. Wouldn't have mattered. And then the sixth step, when I find out that all the willpower and all the strength in the world, I can't change myself. And I'm driven to my knees in the seventh step, like the original manuscript said, humbly, on my knees, ask God to remove these defects of character, holding back nothing. You know, I was a guy who thought that he lied because he didn't know the truth. And then, you know, all of a sudden I knew the truth, and I told God, I won't lie anymore, and I stood there and watched myself lie. In my head, I'd be saying, shut up, but my mouth has a mind of its own. And I'd lie when I didn't need to lie. I'd steal when I didn't need to steal. And then I'd beg God, please, please, please change this. And my friend St. Paul always says, you know, that God leaves us with something that we can't straighten out. And then we're constantly reminded that we need him. And then, you know, there was the eighth step when I listed all those people I had harmed. And it said to go back as far as my mind could carry me. And I did. And the great freedom in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, as Michael so beautifully described last night, comes in a ninth step. When I make it right with the rest of the world, and a tremendous freedom comes there. And that's the time I got to go to Dumb Danny and explain to him why I had said all those nasty things about him. I said, you know, it's hard to have a brother like you who does everything once. And he said, you know, as long as I've lived, Keith, he said, I've admired you more than any man in the world. I said, you have? He said, yeah. He said, I've always been afraid. And he said, I was always afraid to make a change. And he said, you never gave a damn about anything. He said, if things weren't going well in one country, you go to another country. He said, you've been in more schools and universities than I can count. And he said, you've majored in everything. Yeah. And I found out that Denny and I are just different. That's all. We're just different. We're just wired differently. You know, next week I'm going to go out and play in this member guest golf tournament. We get together two, three times a year. We love one another very, very much. You know, that father who never told me he loved me, I was able to sit down with Dad and do that eighth step or that ninth step. And he told me the real truth. He said to me, he said, because I thought he wasn't interested in my life. And he said, remember the day you went to work? He said, you were 13 years old. I said, yeah, I remember, Dad. And he said, you had a job setting pins in a bowling alley in Bridgeport, at Jimmy Lamont's bowling alley. And I said, yeah. I was kind of surprised he remembered that. And he said, remember your first day of work? I said, I don't think so. He said, I took you to lunch. He said, we went to Louis' hot dog stand. Do you remember what you ate? And I said, probably a hot dog. And he said, yeah. And he said, do you remember what you drank? I said, probably an orange pop. I always drank orange pop. He said, no, son. He said, that day you drank root beer. He said, I think you thought that men who work drank root beer because I drank root beer. And he said, I explained to you what it was to give a good day's work for a good day's wage. And he said, and I walked you down to the bus stop. And he said, you were getting on a bus. And I said to you, son, do you want me to come with you on the first day? And you said to me, no, thanks, Dad. I can do it myself. And he said, I watched my skinny little 13-year-old boy get on a bus. And he said, I watched the bus till it was out of sight. And you never looked back. And I realized that I had cut that man out of my life. I thought I was supposed to. There were so many of us. I thought I was the oldest. I was supposed to get a job. I was supposed to pay for my clothes and my books and everything. And he said, everybody went to college. I mean, almost all my brothers and sisters went to college, and my father helped every one of them. He said, you never let me help you. And I said, I'm so sorry, Dad, that I robbed you of the ability to do what you do better than anything else, and that's to be a father. And a few months later, I borrowed some money from him. And I paid him back. And he told me, I love you. You know, a few Mondays ago, we buried my mom. And this strong, wonderful man, 83 years old, was so strong through the whole thing and so loving. And he kissed her on the forehead before we closed the coffin and said, they knew one another. 59 years. They were married for 56 years. And they raised 11 of their own children, and they raised kids who didn't have any place else to go. Nobody adopted kids. You just took them in. Hundreds and hundreds of people came through that funeral parlor in this tiny town in Ohio. Kids came from all over the place, and they brought their kids. And they had 11 of their own children and 19 grandchildren and 18 great-grandchildren. And less than 24 hours after my mother was buried, Dad had a severe stroke. And he's going to have surgery in this coming week. I hope you'll remember him in your prayers. But what I want for him is God's will. That's all I want for any of us. See, I used to think I knew what was best for everybody, and I discovered I was wrong. I can't tell you what it's meant to me to be here, to be back here. After all these years. You know, this is the first place I ever spoke at a conference. And I've always remembered you so very, very fondly. And fortunately or unfortunately, it's been hundreds of times since then. And I'll never forget you. And I'll never forget this wonderful little town and this wonderful sobriety that you have in this part of the country, in Georgia. And I would be honored to be remembered by you fondly. And I would be very, very honored to walk with you on this road to happy destiny. If I can leave you with any thought at all, it's know that we've been wrong. Thank you.